Your attention, please. The Thunder Mesa Limited, now leaving for a grand circle tour through the realms of Imagineering, Model Railroading, and Disney Trains. All passengers, board!
Howdy, folks! Welcome aboard the Thunder Mesa Limited. I am your host, Dave Mee, coming to you from Thunder Mesa Studio in historic Jerome, Arizona. This is the show where we talk to all kinds of creative folks from the worlds of Imagineering, modeling, trains, and most of all, Disney trains. You're listening to Season 1, Episode 5, and our guest today is Disney railroad historian Michael Campbell. Michael is a noted authority on Walt Disney's railroading interests and has been a leader in education and preservation efforts at Walt's Barn and the Walt Disney Family Museum. He has produced exhibits, talks, and presentations for Disney parks, museums, and professional organizations, and he's been a driving force behind the creation of Disney railroading scale models and collectibles. We'll be talking with Michael about all of that and so much more right after this important word from our sponsor.
This episode brought to you by Atencio Crump and Gracie, Undertakers. Caught in an unexpected shootout? Lost in a horrific mine accident? Hung by mistake? Or perhaps simply carried away by a runaway mine train? Whatever the method of your untimely demise, Atencio Crump and Gracie promise the very best in eternal rest. Our fine pine caskets are second to none. In fact, we're the last carpenters you'll ever need. Trust Atencio Crump and Gracie for all of your final arrangements. Just across from Boot Hill in Thunder Mesa. To date, we've served over 999 uncomplaining customers. But there's room for 1,000. Hurry back, and don't forget your death certificate.
And now, please welcome to the program, Mr. Michael Campbell. Hi, Michael.
Oh, Dave, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for doing this. Thanks for taking the time to coming on. You're a busy guy with all of these things going on. I'm looking at your stuff here. You know, I consider myself a hardcore Disney train nerd, but brother, I got nothing on you.
Well, I don't know about that, Dave, but I would suggest that my hobby has turned beyond passion and into obsession.
Well, that's, you know, that's great. That's a great thing.
Oh, it's great for me, not so great for everyone else.
Well, you know, it's like before I knew who you were, before I knew you, anytime I would, you know, scratch the surface of any kind of Disney-related railroad thing, there would be this guy's name, Michael Campbell, and he would come up, and I would come up and come up with conversation with friends, and you're like the man behind the curtain, you know. So, I wanted to ask you before anything else, how did you become a historian specializing in Walt Disney's railroad interests? Because that is a very specific and unique field of study.
It is an odd speciality, and yeah. It's one of those things that in retrospective, I'm not even sure that I could have predicted I would have ended up here, but yet here we are.
Right.
And I could give you the full story, but you probably want to keep this particular episode less than the length of the ring cycle. So let's go with the Reader's Digest version.
Okay.
My father and my brother were really into steam railroading, big force in their life. And so before I could walk or talk, I was introduced to trains, and it bit me hard. My first trip to Disneyland when I was about 6 years old, we lived in Northern California, so we didn't get down to Southern California very often at all. My first trip was, from my perspective, a reason to go ride on a railroad, and then there was some stuff in the middle of the railroad, but I didn't really care about the stuff.
Right.
I'd convinced my parents to let me dress up as a railroad engineer. And the first thing we did when we got to the park is I had to go ride the train.
Right.
So I'm standing there at Main Street Station waiting for the train to come in, and one of the station agents sees me standing there, this little blonde-haired kid wearing a hickory stripe outfit with the cap and the bandana, right, the whole thing. And talked to my parents, apparently, because when the Ernest S. Marsh rolled in, I went to go get on that first coach right behind the tender, and he said, "No, you come with me, son." And he took me by the hand, led me around that little barricade they have, and puts me up on the footplate of the locomotive. And the engine crew were great, and they were starting to explain to me, you know, well, this is how we operate the locomotive, and I'm 6 years old, and I know it way better than they do, and I'm explaining to them they should operate the locomotive. So then it was time to depart. We got the all aboard, and the engineer picks me up and puts me on his lap, excuse me, and tells me to pull the whistle twice, and I knew exactly what that meant, so I reached up, pulled the rope twice, and he opens up the throttle, and off we went for a grand circle tour around the Magic Kingdom. And even though it's been more than 50 years, I can tell you to this day what it felt like, what it looked like, the heat off the backhead, the flash of light in the tunnels. It was thrilling and a little bit scary. It was exhilarating. It was like nothing ever before or since. Wow. And it seared into me this love of not just steam railroading, but Disney trains.
Right.
So we do the Grand Circle tour. We come back to Main Street Station. And at this point, I remembered I had parents. And I went running back to tell them about it. And my mom asked me about it. Now, the next part, I simply do not remember, but I have no reason to doubt my mother's word. She asked me how it was. And I said, I exploded, as only an excited six-year-old can do. And then I said, when I grow up, I want a real Disney train in my backyard. And my mother laughed. Like, yeah, right. I mean, I might as well ask for the Titanic. And then about 30 years later, I put a real Disney train in my backyard.
Right, right. We're going to get to that later. Yeah.
Just yeah. What happened in between those two moments.
Right. Well, that's a great story. Yeah, similar to you, that was my first introduction to steam railroading. Was, of course, I grew up in Orange County, just half an hour away from Disneyland, and the first steam train I ever saw was, you know, pulling into Main Street Station about the same age, and I always describe it as, you know, it comes in, it's red and green and gold, it's those are the colors of Christmas, and in a child's mind, it just becomes, you know, the most magical thing you've ever seen. It just gets under your skin and it never gets out. That's a great story.
And as a side note, when there's not a pandemic going on,
right,
there are more than 50,000 people a day riding a live steam railroad because of Walt Disney.
Right.
No one has really done as much to promote steam railroading than he did.
That's a great point. Yeah.
And it's you know, depending on your perspective, it's either been a miraculous revelation or it's been a crippling disease that he's inflicted upon these folks.
Well, for some of us, it's a crippling disease. Stunts our growth and our maturity, but that's okay. There's a lot to be said for that, too. So, so you become a Disney rail. You do the deep dive. You become a Disney railroading historian, and this is one of the hats you wear, and you produce these presentations and museum exhibits and shows and stuff like that. And how fun! I mean, I know there's stress and work involved and everything too, like anything, but it's fun.
You know. I don't jump around in the story, but when we were able to get the Fort Wilderness equipment, I had to have some place to put it. So right. I had to lay 45 feet of narrow gauge track in my backyard,
right,
which is, you know, a significant effort. And it was just me. So I had to ask some of my friends to help. And as luck would have it, it was a blistering hot day. And I'd gotten the ties and the rails from a local railroad supply company and the spikes. And we're going to do it the John Henry way, you know. We're going to sledgehammer, bang it in, right, that kind of thing. It was 118 degrees outside that day. And one of my best friends is standing there in the mid-afternoon with just drenched in sweat. and our arms are aching from doing all this hard labor. And I looked over and I said, I am so sorry to ask you to do this work. And he looks at me with this grin that I could recognize in myself. And he said, this isn't work.
That's not work.
So right. Yes, there is certainly an amount of effort that goes into planning these things. And I can't say that everything always goes smoothly. Nothing does.
Right.
But at the end of the day, it is a privilege to be able to do these things. It is not work.
That's absolutely right. It is a privilege. And I am privileged to know, I just thinking about this, I know two people who have full-size Disney steam trains in their backyard. That's amazing. Anyway, let's move on to Walt's Barn.
Sure.
Walt's Barn. Just briefly, how'd you get involved with the restoration and relocation of Walt's Barn?
Well, I should back up just a little bit to help explain my entree into this unique world.
Yes.
In 1998, Michael Broghi, son of Disney legend Roger
Broghi, yeah.
Wrote a really wonderful book called Walt Disney's Railroad Story. I bought it when I was at, I see it on your shelf behind you. And I bought it when I was on vacation at Walt Disney World shortly after it came out. And then he happened to be doing a signing at a local bookstore where I lived at the time. And I went over to meet him. And he did a little presentation, and we went and chatted afterwards, and we just became instant friends.
Yeah.
And he invited me to serve on the Board of Governors of the Society. And that's how I ended up getting into making all these models of Disney-related trains and doing presentations and so forth. Yeah. Because Michael was great. He would suggest that we should come up with new ideas, and I would come up with something that was totally insane, and entertain it, and then we'd go off and talk to other people, and they'd entertain it,
mm-hmm.
and everything sprung from that. So I joined the story just as Walt's Barn was being completed at Griffith Park. We dedicated it on July, I shouldn't remember the date. I don't think it was July 17th, but it was close to it, 1999.
Mm-hmm.
It was really a special thing to do because Walt was a founding member of the Los Angeles Live Steamers.
Right.
And when he pulled up most of the Carowood track from his Holmby Hills estate, he donated it to the Los Angeles Live Steamers, and they right. used it to construct what is still today called the Disney Loop.
Right.
The barn was put right into the middle of that. So it was perfectly appropriate for right. Walt's barn to find a home there.
Yeah.
And then we had this barn that was largely empty. The family, Walt's surviving daughter Diane and her kids, were really great about loaning things to put on display in the barn. And we had to go dig through all this stuff at their storage facilities to pull out all the train stuff.
That's tough duty.
It was funny because you think of Walt Disney as this legendary figure, you know, one of the most famous people of the 20th century,
right?
And who has, you know, directly or indirectly touched the lives of most of the people on the planet. You know, that's a remarkable figure. But at the end of the day, he was somebody's dad and somebody's grandpa, and he had stuff, and they put it in storage.
Right.
And so we're going through looking for like the old track control board that would, in theory, control all the switches on the Carowood mm-hmm. Pacific. And we're digging through all this stuff, and we have found like mounted trophy heads, animal heads, and one of them was like a hollowed out leg of an elephant that had been turned into an umbrella stand. And I asked Diane about it, and it was part of a joke. Her dad hated hunting. He thought killing animals for sport was just wrong,
yeah.
right? Especially a beautiful animal like an elephant.
Right.
And so for one of his birthdays, a bunch of his friends gave him these things as kind of a joke, and he put them up at, well, what would have been Club 33 had mm-hmm. he lived long enough to see it. And that's how it turned into, as you may be aware, the talking vulture
right.
that is now in the current incarnation of the club.
Right.
Because he thought, fine, you're going to give me these things, I'm going to put them on the wall, but then they're going to listen into your conversations
right.
and respond to you, right? Which is a very, when you think about it, that's an absolute Walt kind of thing to come up with.
Right.
Well, when they refurbished the club in the mid-70s, they pulled all those out, gave them back to the family who had no interest in putting them in their homes and were in storage.
Yeah.
And that's where you stop to think, wow, this was, you know, a famous person, but still just somebody's dad and grandpa.
Right. Yeah, everything. Who's got a storage unit? Just like Full of old junk. You know, you said coming up with these outrageous ideas that, you know, couldn't possibly happen. That's really a Walt Disney kind of thing, too. You know, he did that a lot. So you have that in common with him, which is nice.
Well, I don't make any comparisons between me and Walt.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, it's a good character trait to have. I find that some of my best ideas are outrageous things that everybody else looks at and goes, that's just crazy. If someone's telling you you're doing something crazy, you're probably on the right track, I guess.
Well, yeah, another person of which I'm just a great fan is Jeff Flynn, you know, the co-founder and really the driving force behind the Electric Light Orchestra, the
right.
producer of the Beatles Finals record and right. things like that. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, and he would go on to be as famous for a songwriter and musician as he was a producer. And when someone asked him, well, how did you get into producing records? He said, I asked them if I could produce the record, and they said yes. And so when you think about what he would go on to do, it was all because he went, can I do this? And they said, sure. Yeah. And so I've tried to learn from that when you think of, wow, could we actually make models of Walt's trains and sell right. them? Well, most people go, oh, wow, no, we'd have to do this and that. And they think of all the barriers between you and getting that done.
Right, exactly.
And somebody like Walt and Jeff just say, can we try it? And often the answer is, sure. It doesn't mean it's going to be successful, but at least we'll try.
Yeah, I've got to
try to follow that philosophy.
Yeah, that's a great philosophy to have. I actually have a sign up in my studio to remind me that says, if you don't ask, the answer is always no.
I love that. Dave, that is spot on. The way I've also heard that expressed is that it doesn't matter whether you say you can or you cannot. You're right.
You're right either way. Right, right. Well, you know, and speaking of facilitating things with Walt's Barn, I just have to, just as an aside here, say a public thank you for helping us, my partner Jake Johnson and I, get the Walt Disney Barn kit out there for the 20th anniversary, when you were producing the 20th anniversary celebration for Walt's Barn at Griffith Park, and we sure appreciate that. And it was a big success, and, you know.
Well, it is a beautiful model, and it's, you know, it's funny. In fact, I don't think you know the story. Shortly after we opened the barn to the public,
mm-hmm.
and I can't imagine any of your listeners aren't aware of this, but just in case, Walt's Barn is open the third Sunday of each month, weather permitting, when there's not a pandemic.
When there's not a pandemic, right.
There's no admission charge. Mm-hmm. Parking is free. It is, as they like to say, the only free Disney attraction in the entire world.
Right.
And so we did want to honor the barn in model form. And Jack mm-hmm. Verducci, who is a master builder, specializes in large-scale models, created a model of Walt's Barn mm-hmm. that is normally on display there. And when I produced an exhibition at Disneyland, we put it in one of the vitrines in the Opera House so people could see it, make
right.
a connection. Because you can draw a straight line between Walt's Barn and Disneyland.
Right.
There's no question there's a...
The birthplace of Imagineering, it's called.
Yeah. That's precisely right. Yeah. That is exactly right. And Jack does beautiful work, but he mm-hmm. couldn't scale it up to where he could make many, 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 many of these.
Right.
And, of course, this was in the early 2000s where mm-hmm. laser printing and all that kind of stuff really wasn't, you know, out there yet. 3D printing was not even really discussed at that point.
Right.
And it was one of those ideas that we knew was great, but it just wasn't the right time for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so happy when you and Jake came forward and said, we'd like to do this. Because I knew the quality would be absolutely first rate. The two of you have built some of the most beautiful models, I think, that exist on the planet.
Oh, Joe.
And I knew anything that you would create would be absolutely first class.
Thank you.
And that's what's so important, because we're trying to honor Walt Disney. And
right.
if there's one thing you can always point to, the work product was the best it could be.
Absolutely, yeah, and right.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dave.
I was just gonna say it was an honor. It was an absolute honor to do it, and you know, it goes back to those crazy ideas. We were just sitting around talking one day, saying, "Hey, we should do a model of Walt's Barn."
Yes,
the 20th anniversary is coming up. That's a good deadline for us. If we can get it done by then, you know, and
sure.
It worked out. So that's fantastic, and I'm glad everybody was happy with it. That's the main thing. Yeah, we wanted to do a first-class job. And
at a first-class job, it absolutely was. And I know many people have enjoyed building it. And I understand you have some news about that. Are you able to share that?
Well, we're not here to plug my stuff, but yeah, there's the HO scale version of Waltz Barn, where the pilot model is being built now. Mm-hmm. Well, not right now, but as you see, when you hear this, it might already be out. Actually, you might see pictures of it by then. Thank you. But let's the Waltz Barn led you to do more museum exhibits and things with the Walt Disney family and get involved with on the ground floor of the Walt Disney Family Museum. Is that right?
Well, and so I need to backfill a little bit of story here. And that is that, and I know this is going to sound like the most first world problem ever, but I worked in information technology in Silicon Valley my whole career. And most folks at that time, the late 90s and early 2000s, lived in cubicles. And when you got an actual hard-walled office, that was kind of a rare achievement. So I finally got one. I got to be a CIO of a semiconductor equipment company. And I thought, well, I've got to decorate my office. And I thought about my many hobbies. And as you might expect, railroading floated immediately to the top.
Right.
And I thought, I've got to have a model of the Lily Bell. You know, this is not just something that Walt liked. His fingerprints were all over it. It looked and was shaped the way that it was because of Walt and the people who helped him, like Jerry Best and Ward Kimball. Mm-hmm. And there was no model of the Lily Bell. And I asked Michael Broghi, and I said, have we ever tried to do this? And he said, well, we talked to LGB once, but they weren't interested in really customizing anything. They'd take a stock model and kind of paint it for us. Mm-hmm. But no one got excited about that, because if it doesn't really look like it, then why are you putting the name on it?
Right.
And I said, do you mind if I try? So I reached out to a number of different manufacturers, and Heartland Locomotive Works in LaPorte, Indiana, was absolutely all for it. In fact, the owner of that has one of the original Disney-built Lily Bell clones. Your listeners may not be aware that Walt Disney, after building the Lily Bell, reasonably thought, well, other people might want to have something like this, and we can sell the parts of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And so the machine shop at the studio was selling these things as part of the Walt Disney Miniature Locomotive Company around 1952-53.
Wow.
And very few complete engines exist, and Ken Coates owned one of them. So he said, absolutely, we're all in. We'll do the custom work, the tooling necessary to do that. But, of course, we needed to get Diane's permission.
Right.
And so I had met Diane at the barn dedication, and I contacted her, and she says, that's a terrible idea. I hate it.
Really?
Not quite the reaction I was looking for. And she says, I don't want people to commercialize on my dad's hobby, you know, because... And I won't speculate as to what dynamic might have existed between them and the Walt Disney Company, but she felt like this is my dad's own personal thing. It's not part of the company.
Right.
And I'm worried about it being, you know, seen as a tawdry thing. Right.
Right.
And I totally get that. But I talked to her, and I was able to persuade her that this would be done first class, that the proceeds would go to support Walt's barn. You know, so it's not just a money grab kind of thing. And she agreed to it. So Heartland produced it. And we premiered it at Disneyland, because that was the most logical place for someone to go buy it.
Right.
And I thought, we're going to be lucky if we can sell 100 of these things. Because a large-scale model, $500, is kind of a lot of money, right?
Right.
And they sold out in an hour. And they would go on to sell about 2,000 of them. I think we did 1955 or something cute like that.
Right.
And we realized there was a market for this. And so Diane loved it, because now people were able to connect with her dad as a human being, and this was his hobby. And we used the box to tell the story of how this come Disneyland. And she said, this is great. So we would go on to make other things about that. And one day I had suggested Diane, this was very close to the 100th birthday of her father, that we could do an exhibition at the State Railroad Museum.
Right.
In Sacramento. And she said, absolutely, let's do it. And that's where we brought the Lily Bell up and all these other things. Mm-hmm. And as part of this, she got the idea that maybe the public would react to some kind of a permanent exhibition about her dad. A lot of people know the name Walt Disney, but even today, some people think it's a corporate symbol, like Betty Crocker, somebody that never actually lived.
Right.
It was a made-up brand. She was very concerned about that. She had purchased one of the barracks at the Presidio, which was converting over from a military base into private use. And the idea was to get all these things out of the storage units and put them on display. Mm-hmm. As she remarked to me, you know, my grandkids haven't even seen all these things.
Yeah.
There was one day, and I'm not making this story up, this is absolutely true. We were going through looking for railroad stuff to put on display at the barn, and there was a Florsheim shoebox. And that Florsheim shoebox had tissue paper in it. And I opened the lid and looked inside, and I had asked what was in it. She said, I don't remember. And I pull out this little Oscar. Looks like an Oscar statue, but it's short, right?
Right.
And I move some more papers over. Oh, there are seven of them. And I realized this was the Special Academy Award, the only time they've ever done this.
Right.
That they did for Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs in 1937, I think it was.
Yeah.
Sent it to him by Shirley Temple.
Right.
And it's a Florsheim shoebox in a storage container in Glendale, California. And she says, we really need to get these things out on display. And so that started with the little barracks, and it was very much like Disneyland, which was supposed to be this little Mickey Mouse park next to the studio, and hey, you could have a carousel, you know, we could have a stagecoach ride, maybe a steamboat, and the idea kept growing and growing. Mm-hmm. Well, the same thing happened with Walt Disney Family Museum. It started out as, well, we'll have these things on display, and we could have school groups come through. Oh, and then we could have a research area for people studying animation. Oh, maybe we could have a little cafe. And obviously, this is not going to fit in the barracks.
Right.
Or their little warehouse. And so they ended up buying a 77,000 square foot former barracks on the parade grounds. And that became the Walt Disney Family Museum. I was invited to participate in the design of this. Diane had taken to calling me her train guy. I was probably, considering who she was and who her dad was, one of the best titles I've ever received.
Right.
And so I helped with all the railroad related exhibits on display at the museum. Part of this was that they had acquired the former gymnasium at the parade grounds, a very short walk from where these barracks were located, and they intended to use it for a rotating exhibition hall. Mm. So they could focus on one particular topic, making a Pinocchio, the Nine Old Men, things like that. And I had suggested to Diane that there was enough about Walt and trains that we could do a whole exhibition there, and she agreed. Unfortunately, she passed away before we could open it. But we did open it around the fifth anniversary of the museum, and it got extended twice, and I don't have the current figures, but it was, at the time, the most popular exhibition that they had produced in terms of foot traffic, because it really appealed to all ages, because who doesn't love a train, right?
Right.
And so all of these things, Dave, were all accidental. I never intended to do any of these, and it was more like I saw an idea, and I thought, hey, that'd be kind of fun. Could we do that? And you ask the right people, and then you do it.
Happy accidents.
Happy accidents, indeed.
That's right. So, well, that's fantastic. You know, I wanted to touch on, you talked about the Heartland Lilybell model, but you went on to produce more models in the same vein.
Sure.
Tell how you moved from the Heartland model to the AccuCraft, the live steam, and so on and so forth. Because that's a great story. I've heard it tell before, and it's funny.
But, well, it's I appreciate that you enjoy the story. It just keeps pointing out to me how little I know and how unimaginative I am. So we, as I mentioned, premiered the Heartland Lilybell model at the Disney Gallery on Main Street at Disneyland. There was a line down the block for people who wanted to buy this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so Disneyland was very gracious, and they invited me to be there for the opening of this. And so people are in line, and I'm chatting with them. And this one fellow just dresses me down about how bad this product is. Heartland was willing to invest some tooling, but there were some things that would have been very expensive for them to create perfectly for the Lilybell.
Mm-hmm.
With not seeing the numbers. If you only have 100 units to amortize your costs over, you can't invest $50,000 in tooling and still make the price reasonable for the average person, right? And so there were a few compromises, like the length of the boiler, that weren't exactly right. And this person, well, Walt would have never allowed this, you know, which, and I wasn't going to say anything in front of all these guests on stage at Disneyland, but anytime somebody says Walt would have never, they probably don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And I don't even pretend to imagine what he would have thought about different things. But Diane was very clear about this. There were people that worked with him for 30 years that could not predict the next thing he was going to do. So if they couldn't know how he was going to react to something, there's no way that anybody else could possibly know.
Right.
Right. So he may have liked it. He may have hated it. We just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But the point was, it wasn't as accurate as it could be. And so I told the fellow, look, if you want it to be perfect, we could have AccuCraft make this. But it's going to cost $2,000 because essentially they're going to hand build each one.
Right.
And he said, where do I write the check? And then so I thought, well, I could talk to them. And Bing Chang, very, very good friend of mine, president of AccuCraft Train, said, sure, we could do it. And I said, look, no one's going to want these things. That's too much money. You'll be lucky to sell 10 of them, right? So give me a price and we'll go out and we'll tell people about it. And I'm thinking, well, I hope Bing doesn't end up with these sitting, you know, on a shelf unsold, right? 173 would go on to be sold in the hands of different collectors. And, mm-hmm. and if we had not put on the limited edition of 173, probably could have sold 500 of them at $2,000 each.
Right.
And it just shows that I completely did not understand the market, the desire for these things. And I am of all the different models that we've made, I'm proud of each, obviously, but the AccuCraft one really is the crowning achievement.
Yeah.
There are only three things that I had to change as a compromise from the actual Lily Bell engine. And I've never told anybody who those three are, and I'm not telling you now.
Oh! Yeah. No fair.
But they're true minutiae. You would have to be psychotically obsessed with the details of the Lily Bell to know which those three details are.
Well, if there's anyone out there who's psychotically obsessed, they're listening to this show.
Yeah, that's true. If I haven't put them to sleep by now,
no,
they probably are interested.
That's fantastic. Yeah, and I should note as that the reason the number 173 was put as a cap on there is for CP-173, which the Lily Bell was based on, Central Pacific 173. So that's one of those numbers that has a lot of meaning in Disney nerd railroad circles.
it is, and yeah. there's a little bit of a tie there. This is a quick story. The Central Pacific 173. Which was created by master mechanic A.J. Stevens, was the very first locomotive truly constructed in California.
Right.
At the time, before the Transcontinental Railroad, any locomotives were actually built on the East Coast and then shipped around the Horn mm-hmm. and then up the coast. It took a long time for them to get there, and then they were just simply put together, mm-hmm. right? What was the 173 was involved in a very serious accident in Alameda in 1872, I want to say. And they took what was left over, the parts from this locomotive, and A.J. Stevens used it to rebuild it. But by the time he was done, it was almost a completely different locomotive. It was one, it's like we call a bell upgrade.
Right.
You have an old locomotive, you lift up the bell, you roll a new one down, and you put the bell back down.
Everything behind the number plate is
exactly. It's all new stuff, right? Right. And it was a very popular design, very sturdy, had great tractive effort. Mm-hmm. They would go on to build 12 of them, and they served a while, but then nobody thought of them as being special, and powerful locomotives were coming along, and so most of them were scrapped. One exists, the Dayton, number 18 of the Virginia and Truckee Railroad, right. And it's at the Nevada State Railroad Museum.
Right.
So we had borrowed the Lily Bell to put on display in Sacramento for the exhibition there. And it was going into the roundhouse, and I said, wouldn't it be cool? This is another one of those, I have no idea what I'm talking about, so I might as well suggest it. Let's borrow the Dayton from the Nevada State Railroad Museum, trade them with one of the locomotives that they have here, and that way they have a new exhibition as well. And that way the Lily Bell will be right next to a sister engine to the progenitor, the real CP-173. Mm-hmm. That'd be cool. And everybody said, that'd be cool. And then the state said, we don't have any money. And as a side note, and I don't think many people know this, the whole exhibition would not have occurred without Ron and Diane Miller.
Mm.
because the state loved the idea about putting on this exhibition, but they were broke.
Right.
And so Ron and Diane paid for the whole exhibition.
Mm.
It was a significant amount of money.
Yeah.
But that's how passionate they felt that we should do this thing. The cost of adding the other I didn't want to embarrass myself asking Diane if we could borrow all this money to borrow another locomotive.
Right.
And so that's why we didn't do that.
Well, you know, that brings us kind of in a circle back to the Disneyland Railroad, because
sure.
The C.K. Holiday and the E.P. Ripley, the original two locomotives of the Disneyland Railroad, are based sort of on Lily. You know, I see a lot. Oh, it's a 5/8. No, they're not exactly, but they're based closely on CP-173 and the Lily Bell, though they mm-hmm. represent different time periods in railroading history. They're you know, a couple of decades apart.
That's right.
And I wanted to ask you about the builder's plates for those, because you were involved in that shenanigan also.
Yeah, I was. And so the backstory there is that the 50th anniversary of the park was approaching.
Right.
And Michael Brogy challenged me. He said, we got to do something cool for the 50th anniversary of the railroad. And I was thinking, what could we do that wouldn't just be some kind of a, you know, silly flag on it or something like that? Something really permanent and meaningful. When they constructed engines 1 and 2 at the studio, the boilers were made by Dixon, which was in Southern California. Most of the work was done at the studio, and the final assembly was done at the park. They didn't put builder's plates on them.
Mm-hmm.
And we still don't know why, because that is a very standard feature of steam locomotives.
Right.
If you see a real steam locomotive doesn't have a builder's plate, it probably means somebody stole it.
Right.
Because right. they're also very collectible.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, you know, we could do builder's plates for this. And that would be, you know, a way for us to pay homage to the history of the locomotives, but in a subtle way. Most people wouldn't notice that the builder's plate date was 1955.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, the Disneyland Railroad, as you just mentioned, is supposed to be set in the 1870s to the 1890s,
right?
Right. That's a little bit of an anachronism, but that's a subtle tribute to the fact that the locomotives, and thereby extending to the entire railroad, was 50 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So Michael thought it was a great idea, and even though Diane did not own the trains anymore, while Walt was alive, the railroad was his personal property, did not
right.
belong to Disneyland Incorporated. After he passed, Mrs. Disney held on to it and the monorail through Retlaw Enterprises, their private company.
Right.
When Michael Eisner became CEO, he realized that he didn't own everything that was in the park, and he didn't even have the rights to the name Walt Disney, and so he made a deal where he acquired all of those things from Mrs. Disney for a significant amount of stock. And so we wanted to get the family's permission because it was just the right thing to do, not because they had any legal requirement to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I also thought this could be a way to kind of pay a little tribute to the fact that these were his personal possessions during
mm-hmm.
that time. So I based the builder's plates on two different manufacturers to represent the different
ages time periods.
The outline
yeah.
is supposed to look like. The C.K. Holiday, we decided, would be based on a Baldwin design plate, a round plate. And it was very common for them to put the plant manager's names
mm-hmm.
on the builder's plate, in addition to the construction number and the date of manufacture. On the E.P. Ripley, we decided to make that look like a Rogers outline, because the actual trim of the engine is based on a Rogers.
It's very Rogers, yes.
And which is a rectangular plate with little notched corners, but would also have a call back to the general manager mm-hmm. of the company built it, right? And I wanted to use the name Retlaw on there, because that way we can say, you know, for a while, these were actually owned by Retlaw, and before
right.
that, Walt Disney Incorporated and so forth. And they owned the Retlaw name. And Diane said, I love this. Absolutely. Let's do it. You have permission to do it. And so we went to the park. The park was fantastic. They said, we love this. It's exactly the kind of tribute that we would love to do. One of the alternative ideas, and not many people know this, they were going to take one of the locomotives and paint it gold, the entire thing.
Oh.
Yeah.
Why doesn't that surprise me?
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing about shiny gold is that it doesn't stay shiny in gold very long when there's steam spewing out of it and oil and everything else. It would have looked pretty bad pretty fast.
Right.
So the builder's plates gave them that plus to an original attraction without, you know, dipping it in gold paint. And they loved it. And then I said, okay. And I worked with some historians to make sure I was getting everything right, because I did not want to get to a point where we put the plates on the trains and some guy comes along and says, Walt would have never done that because this was wrong, that kind of thing. So I talked to folks at the State Railroad Museum, some other historians, and we felt very good about the designs. Mm-hmm. So then we go and we show the final designs to the park, and they said, well, you've used these names and we don't own those names on it. Well, yeah, but we have permission. And they said, well, yeah, but we don't like that, because someday some heir of that family could sue us for putting it on somewhere in our park. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, what's the alternative? Well, what you do is you have an agreement with them. You trademark the design of the plate. You give us a license. And that way, if they ever come back, they're suing you, not us.
Not you. Not them.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. If that's what it takes. So we had to draw these agreements.
Right.
So this is something a lot of people don't know. Not only did I come up with the idea for the builder's plates and help with the design, but they're actually my trademark.
You own the license on that, huh? Wow.
And I licensed it. I gave a permanent, irrevocable license to Disneyland to put them on the locomotives. Yeah. If you were to pry the plates off of the trains on the backside, you'd actually see copyright Michael Campbell.
Wow. See, now there's a legacy right there. There's a time capsule.
It's an odd one that most people don't know, and I have to tell you, most people wouldn't care. It's really trivial.
I care, Michael.
There's a little satisfaction that I get knowing that in a very small way, I've been able to contribute to the legacy that is the Disneyland Railroad.
Well, that's a great story.
Side note to that.
Yeah, go ahead.
And this is really important. They assigned somebody from Walt Disney Imagineering to work on this with me. It's not like we did it in a total vacuum.
Right.
And this is how I met my dear, dear friend, Ray Spencer, who was a guest on this very show.
He was.
Not too long ago.
Uh-huh.
And it was so wonderful working with him. And he was such a wonderful font of knowledge about all these things. It was just pure fun working, collaborating with him on this.
Yeah.
And he and I would go on to become not just great friends, but business partners, because we loved working with each other so much.
I-5, right.
Yeah. That's exactly right.
Yeah. That's great. Yes. Ray is a mutual friend. Great guy. I love his dry sense of humor. He can deliver a joke just like and not crack a smile at all. I didn't know what to make of it the first time I met him. First time I met him in person was at Fullerton Railroad Days, and we were chatting. We walked by the Carolwood booth, you know, for Walt's barn, and he's like, "Oh, I don't want to talk to these guys. They're just hardcore nerds, you know, just total straight face." I'm like, "Oh, okay, Ray."
But Ray's a hardcore nerd.
I know. I know, that's why it was so funny.
Those are his people.
those are my people. Oh.
So quick note about Ray before we move on, because this is my favorite Ray story. I would say that in the dictionary, next to the word humble, there'd be a photo of Ray, but he wouldn't send in the photo because he's too
right.
humble.
Somebody else would have to send it in, right?
And he has designed or had a hand in the design of some of the most iconic things you can see at the parks. And when he does them, they're done so beautifully. But he doesn't talk about them. And mm-hmm. and this has led to a recurring running gag with us where I will mention, oh, I've heard about this, and then he'll look at me and go, yeah, I designed that. It's like, you didn't think to mention that to me before now?
I've had exactly the same conversation. Helpful. We were talking about Knott's Berry Farm one time, and he goes, "Oh yeah, I did that." I'm like, yeah. Jesus, right?
It's true. It's true.
Anyway, the other models that you were you involved with the Casey Jr. and the and of course then there were Lily Bells done in other scales. I have one of the HO ones behind me on my mm-hmm. on my shelf here because I can't afford the Accucraft model. Not yet. Of course, now they just keep going up in value. Combine 101. I mean, that if there's a favorite railroad car of mine, that's got to be it. I love that car. You helped, of course, to acquire it for Walt's Barn, raise the money, and get it there. And I was involved very peripherally, indirectly with that. I created a piece of artwork that I donated that they auctioned off, and I was very happy to do that.
I remember.
Yeah. And talk about getting Combine 101 a little bit, if you can, and where it was and what state it was in and how it got to Walt's Barn.
Sure.
Yeah.
So the Ratlaw 1 Yellow Passenger Consist was one of the original two train sets at the park.
Right.
And the Combine was very special to Walt. When Walt was a teenager, he had a job for a while as a news butch, right, a vendor that walked the commuter cars selling newspapers and cigarettes and candy and things like that out of a hamper. He'd take his breaks in the baggage compartment of a Combine, which I guess most of your audience would know, but just to be clear, a Combine has its name because it's a combination of freight and passengers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was used on short line railroads or any time where they didn't need a fully dedicated baggage car or passenger car.
Right.
So he'd take his brakes out there and he'd go out the front door of it, climb over the tender while the locomotive was running, because, you know, this was 1915, you could do those kinds of things. And he'd go talk to the cab crew because, you know, there is one thing that he and I have in common. We're not shy.
not afraid to ask,
and,
right.
Ask them about how to operate a locomotive, and he'd give them, you know, bribes essentially in the form of sodas and candy, and they'd show him how to run a locomotive, right? And that seared in him that love of railroading his whole life.
Right.
And so when he was planning the Disneyland Railroad, he said, we need to have a combine. And Stanford Research Associates did the initial estimates on the attendance for Disneyland and everything, and said, well, if you take away that passenger seating, you're giving up money, because in all likelihood, trains are going to be full most of the time. And anybody that says Walt only did this stuff for the money does not understand Walt Disney.
No.
He wanted the Combine there because it was true to the story.
Right.
Right. If you had been on a passenger train of that era, there would have been a Combine car. So even though he was giving money out of his own pocket, he literally owned the train himself, right? Mm-hmm. He did it because it was the right thing to do for the overall story.
Right.
And so the Ratlaw 1 set was beloved, and it was not efficient because it only had doors at either end, and it took forever for people to get off and on, and they wanted to be able to reduce the time of the stops at the station. So they went more to using the excursion style cars where you can get in on the bench seating all from the side, very fast to load and unload. Mm-hmm. So the park stopped running it, and it was just sitting there gathering dust. Bill Norrod, who collected full-size railroad equipment, traded them, the Ratlaw 1 Consist, for a Davenport locomotive, which they were going to have as a fifth engine at Disneyland.
Mm-hmm.
And it eventually went to Walt Disney World and then got traded for another one. And that one became Ford Kimball engine, the fifth engine.
That's there now, yeah.
That's there now, which Ray did the art.
Which, I was back to Ray. Yeah, he did the art.
All roads lead back to Ray. All railroads, anyway. And so Bill Norrod now had the Ratlaw 1 Consist. And he had hired Tim LaGailey to do a lot of restoration work. Excuse me. And then Bill passed away, very sadly. Rob Rossi in San Luis Obispo, who owns the Pacific Coast Railroad, wanted to acquire it. And so he bought most of the Ratlaw 1 Consist, with the exception of the Combine, which Bill Norrod family retained, and the Grand Canyon car, which had been turned into the Lilybell Presidential Coach, which operates at the park today. Well, the Norrod family held on to the Combine for a number of years, but after a while, you go, why are we storing this, you know, 45-foot-long coach?
Right.
That was kind of Dad's thing. It's not really our thing. And so I became aware of this, and I talked to the folks at the barn, and I said, you know, we could buy this, restore it. It was pretty much restored anyway, and put it on display. And how cool that would be to have Walt's favorite piece of the railroad right next to Walt's Happy Place barn.
Right.
Right. And people could come and tour through it and get a chance to experience it again. And they said that was great. I went to Diane because, you know, it was a reasonable amount of money to acquire this thing. And so she was very generous with the grant.
Mm-hmm.
But she said, okay, I'm going to get you started, but you got to raise the rest of the money to buy this thing. No problem. And so I got the idea, again, another one of these ridiculous blunders of mine, that I could build these little models, these large-scale models, using a Bachmann kit, paint them up like the combine, mm-hmm. sell them for $1,000.
Right.
And the money would all go to buying the combine, the real combine.
How hard could it be?
And I thought, we'll be lucky, two or three people are going to want these things. I finally called stop at 20.
Yeah.
And I used to have a pool table. And I, at one point, I had more than a dozen cars all in stages of construction lined up on this pool table. And it looked like when they were building the Retlaw 1 cars at the studio on the soundstage, mm-hmm. Except I didn't have 20 laborers. I just had me. And it just it proved once again that I do not know how to estimate anything. So between that and some other fundraisers that we did, like the auction that you mentioned, mm-hmm. a number of people donated original art and right. artifacts, antiques that we could sell. We were able to acquire the money and buy the car, finish the restoration, and now it's on display for people to enjoy when they go to visit Walt's Farm.
That's great. You know, if I'd known you then, I would have helped. I would have helped build those cars. I would have lent a hand. If, you know, time permitting.
Guys, lend hand, actually. They made one or two cars each, which was, you know, right. very lovely of them. Yeah. But when I said, well, it looks like we might have 30, they went, yeah, I have a life.
Right, exactly. Oh, goodness. Okay. You know, we're almost at 50 minutes here. Time is flying. Tempest fugit, as they say. Fort Wilderness, the mm-hmm. Fort Wilderness Railroad. I want to talk to you about that a little bit.
Sure.
This is something that I think maybe a lot of the kids today, they don't even know that it existed. You know, maybe. The Fort Wilderness Railroad ran from 1974 to 1980-ish at the Fort Wilderness Campground at Walt Disney World. And 30-inch gauge, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So a little smaller than the Magic Kingdom Railroad.
Oh, significantly smaller.
Significantly
not just
smaller.
The railroad, but the locomotives themselves were very much smaller. Compared to the,
yeah. The closer to like the Nature's Wonderland size, somewhere in there, yeah.
That's right.
But eventually, for one reason or another, it stopped running. But I'll let you take over from there. Tell a little bit about what you know about. I know you know tons of information about the Fort Wilderness Railroad, but mostly about how you came to own a piece of that. I mean, because that's a fascinating thing, I think.
Well, it does kind of bring the story full circle with what I started with that right. little 6-year-old kid. The Fort Wilderness Railroad, as you noted, ran from actually 73. It had a Golden Spike dedication on January 1st, 74.
Okay.
But trials started in 73, and it more or less shut down in 1980. And I'll explain what I mean by more or less. But we have to start with the origin of it, and that starts with Walt Disney.
Mm-hmm.
So Walt loved Disneyland, but he was frustrated by the fact that they could only afford so much land, and everything around Disneyland had become kind of cheap malls and motels, and it wasn't really a great place. You know, once you got onto the park property, it was great, but, you know, getting there wasn't so wonderful. And they tried seeing if there was an East Coast appetite for Disney attractions with the 1964 World's Fair.
Right.
And that went really well. So Walt said, you know what, let's build an East Coast park. And he really wanted to build Epcot, the Experimental Prototype Community of Tomorrow. And Roy convinced him, his brother Roy, convinced him to build a Magic Kingdom-style park over there that would help fund the construction of Epcot.
Right.
Which wasn't really meant to be a theme park. It was meant to be an actual city.
Right.
And so Walt worked out the original design for Walt Disney World, which had its own airport, its own rail transportation hub, and so forth. And he wanted a campground as part of it because he mm-hmm. wanted an affordable place for people to stay. Now, people want to stay in a luxury hotel, great, have a product for them. Mm-hmm. But people got an RV or they just want to pitch a tent, let's give them a place to stay in the Florida wilderness.
Right.
And so that was in all of the original designs for Walt Disney World. Walt fortunately passed away, but they kept to his wishes and they built Fort Wilderness. Now, when you have a big campground, you have to get people around. And so they thought, well, let's, instead of, you know, having carts and shuttles, let's put in a steam railroad, because Walt would have really enjoyed that. And everyone agreed to it, and Roger Brogy Jr. was in charge of the construction of what was called the Campground Railroad at the time. Bob McDonald, the wonderful Imagineer who designed a lot of Main Street and the Magic Kingdom in Florida, did the livery design for it. Bob Gurr, whom you know, did a lot of the mechanical design for it.
Right.
In fact, it uses a lot of auto parts on it. It has Chevy disc brakes on it.
Right.
Well, because Bob's reasoning is that if we build something custom and it breaks, we got to build another custom one. If
right.
We put car parts on there and it breaks, we go down to the local Kragen and we just buy a replacement. Right.
Right. Right.
Bob's a pretty bright guy.
Very, very practical.
Yeah, very practical, right? And so they scaled it down and they based it on Jerry Best's Ola Mono, which was a Baldwin plantation locomotive. It was built for the Hawaiian sugarcane plantations in the 1870s. It has a 2-4-2 wheel configuration, which is known as the Columbia style, because that locomotive premiered, that wheel configuration premiered at the Columbian Exposition of 1876, and so it had all this lineage, and it was a wonderful idea and not the best execution. It had two significant flaws. The first is that the initial roadbed was terrible and the thing kept derailing. They put it on sand instead of a typical way of building it. They replaced all the track in 1977 to avoid that problem.
Right.
The second flaw was that they scaled it down to where it only had enough water to essentially make one circuit of the expanded railroad. And then they had to add water again. So it was a little bit of an operational hassle. It was much smaller than the locomotives that operated at the Magic Kingdom.
Right.
And then one flaw that I don't think anybody anticipated, but, you know, and it's one of those things that as fans we can't believe. Everybody goes, oh, I wish it was still there. Well, when you're sleeping in a tent and there's a steam locomotive running about 15 yards away from you, blowing its whistle, you know, from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m., you're not so happy. And and so it wasn't that popular with the guests. And so when an engine would go down for repair, they just wouldn't repair it. And they ended up with just one that would only run sporadically. And they brought in these parking lot shuttle things to get people around. And finally, they just stopped using it.
Right.
And Michael Brogy wrote about this in his book. And it said, they're sitting there with an uncertain fate, and you dangle that flag in front of me, and I'm bound to chase it. And I said, well, do you mind if I try? And so we had several conversations with the park management, Imagineering, and so forth. And eventually they agreed, yep, we want these things preserved. And so we were able to acquire what was left of the railroad, 4 locomotives and 16 coaches. And they ended up in the hands of about 4 or 5 different folks. And I was very fortunate to realize my childhood dream by getting one of the locomotives and one of the coaches.
Right. Well, that's, I'm envious. I have train envy. Because they're beautiful. If people haven't seen pictures of them, the graphics, the size, it's a quintessential Disney-esque. They look like LGB models. You know, they do. Or Accucraft. The cute little proportions of them. You know, they're just they're adorable locomotives, and I'm a big fan of that kind of charm and appeal on those things. It's just great.
Well, you bring up a real interesting point, and that's also one of the myths about everything in the Magic Kingdom is 5/8 scale, right? No, it's not.
No, it's not.
It's proportionate to where it looks romantic,
right?
New Orleans Square does not look like the real New Orleans. It's a romantic version. And I've stayed in castles in Europe, and they certainly do not look like Sleeping Beauty Castle.
Right.
It's a romanticized version. And the same thing is true of these locomotives. They are squished and stretched a little bit away from a normal Baldwin design. But the net result is that they look romantic. And especially the color palette that Bob McDonald selected in the pinstriping and everything. They're just gorgeous little engines.
Yeah.
The thing that I learned, though, about childhood wishes, though, is that when I said I wanted a real Disney train when I grew up, I realized as an adult, I left out a key word, operable. little six-year-old should have said, I want a real operable Disney train in my backyard.
Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, getting them to a condition where they can run again is a heroic amount of work.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm not complaining. It's a happy problem to have.
Yeah, it's a beautiful piece of art that sits there.
Well, yes, my very understanding wife calls it the 12-ton lawn ornament.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's good too. Well, that's great. Are there any future projects that you can tell us about? Anything you're working on coming up in the days to come that you can? If you can't, that's fine. I understand. But I understand NDAs and things like that. But if there's anything in the future you can talk about or just hint at, that's.
There are actually.
Great.
And this is not a pitch for my company in the same way that you said it wasn't a pitch for the model.
Right.
So Ray and I had such fun working together, and I've been working with an architect and absolute brilliant designer named Mike Aronson for a number of years, and he's helped on all these different projects over the years. And of course, Bing, I mentioned earlier, we put on the exhibition in San Francisco, and it was a big hit, and he had folks come over from China. Actually, folks from around the world came to visit that show at the Walt Disney Family Museum. But some of the folks came over from the Chinese government, and they said, we want to put on this show in China. And we said, well, that's a great idea. And it is a great idea until you think about your priceless artifacts going out over, 12 hours of ocean. And then it didn't become such a great idea. Mm-hmm. But they said, look, okay, even if we can't do that, we want to do something. And the idea never really went away. And about a year later, we were contacted. They decided to build a first purpose-built tourist railroad in China to go up and visit these amazing falls in the center of the country. And so they invited us to do the design work for it. And we base a lot of it on what the Durango and Silverton is like, steam-powered. And we named it the Thundering Falls Railroad. And if it weren't for a pandemic, it would be under construction right now.
Right.
And so we thought, let's form a little company and do these things when they come along. And we've done a number of different projects over the years. And we're working on some of the coolest things ever right now. And because of non-disclosure agreements, I can't tell you about them. But when I can, you will not be able to avoid hearing about them because they're awesome. But one thing that I can tell you about, there is this wonderful facility called Give Kids the World in Kissimmee, I think it is. It's very close to the Walt Disney World complex, and a lot of these entertainment companies support it. It's for children facing very serious health issues and their families. They're given a home to live in and these attractions at this park that they've built, which are all accommodating the special needs that they might have. And it is a labor of love, all volunteers. It's just fantastic. They had a train attraction there, which is in desperate need of love. And through our connections, we were invited to come in and help redesign it and maybe do an audio track and some narration. And we're working on that right now.
Oh, fun.
And it's one of those things that hopefully by the time we're done, not only will the resulting product be something that fits that whole description of it's romantic, it's lovable, it's a great book, but it's really going to make a difference in the lives of these children. And out of all the things that we got going on right now, Dave, I can't imagine anything better.
That's fantastic. That's great. Yeah. Well, Michael, it's been an absolute pleasure. This hour flew by, and I feel like we just barely scratched the surface on a lot of these things. And you've got such a depth and breadth of knowledge on these subjects. It's great to talk to you. And I want to thank you so much for doing this, and maybe come back again someday if it's not too inconvenient, and we'll do it again. Michael, thanks. I appreciate
it. Thank you so much, Dave, for this, for your readers' patience. I hope if they were suffering from insomnia, I was able to cure it. And I'd be honored to come back someday and tell you even more stories about my inability to make good sound judgment calls.
you seem to be doing all right.
I get lucky.
All right, Michael.
Surround yourself with really great people. That is also a lesson.
That's true. Yes. Surround yourself with great people. And if you don't ask, the answer is always no. And all of my best work is protected by NDAs. That's okay. Great. Put that on your LinkedIn. All right, man. It's been a gas. Thank you so much, and thanks for listening.
Thank you so much.
And that is going to do it for this time, folks. Thank you so much for tuning in, and many thanks to my wonderful guest, Michael Campbell. I hope you'll join us for episode 6, coming the first week in June, when my guest will be David Erickson. Many of you may know David as the creator and host of Fresh Baked, one of the finest Disney vlogs on the internet. Listen in as David and I talk Disneyland fandom and what it takes to be a dedicated Disney vlogger. Until then, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss a single episode, and you can do that via direct RSS feed at thundermesa.studio/podcasts, or on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever fine podcasts be streaming. If you'd like to help get Thunder Mesa Studios podcasts and videos on the air, please consider joining our Patreon campaign. Our patrons get early access and exclusive content for as little as $3 a month. You can find out more at patreon.com/thundermesa. And now, folks, I've got me a train to catch. Keep moving forward, amigos, and adios for now.